Ignite your curiosity with Austin Next. We're watching Austin transform from a thriving ecosystem into a global superstar. With our host, Jason Scharf, we aspire to better comprehend the true nature of innovation. Together, we will uncover what makes a successful ecosystem and navigate the technologies shaping our future. Now let's dive into What's Next?
Are we at the beginning of the biocentury? Is artificial intelligence the unlock to many of the fundamental questions of biology and medicine? And once we uncover these secrets, how do you create a sustainable business model around it? Today, I dive into all these questions and more with AI expert and founder many times over, Micha Breckstone. Micha is a serial entrepreneur with a profound impact on the AI and tech startup ecosystem, particularly within Israel. As the co-founder and president of Chorus AI, he led the company to its acquisition by ZoomInfo for $575 million. He also established Neuralite AI, which secured over $30 million to pioneer new AI technologies. Previously, Micha sold his NLP business to Intel and founded the Founders Club Tel Aviv, the largest network of venture-backed founders in Israel. He's mentored over 130 Israeli startups and invested in 32, playing a pivotal role in building several AI Israeli unicorns. Currently, Micha is the founder and CEO of Somite AI, aiming to become the OpenAI of stem cell biology. The company is developing foundation models to scale the production of human tissues for cell therapies targeting diseases such as diabetes, obesity, and muscular dystrophies. I hope you enjoy our wide-ranging conversation. Micha, yeah. Welcome to Austin Next.
Welcome back, you mean.
That's true. This is, you were part of the South by Southwest, run through last year.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, Jason. It's a real pleasure. It's always a pleasure.
So one of the things we heard Steve Jobs say, the next century is the bio century. We're seeing every tech company and AI jumping into, bio and health. Why is this happening now? What is the convergence point in AI and biology that it makes now such a moment?
Yeah, I think over the last kind of few months, some luminaries, including Demis Hassabis from DeepMind and the CEO of NVIDIA and also Lisa from AMD, have all been talking about the next frontier being biology. I think ever since ChatGPT was released and the kind of the frontiers of language have been quote unquote conquered, we're looking for deeper, bigger problems to solve. And it's not only biology, right? It's all the physical sciences and what AI can help do there. And I think biology is extremely compelling, first because of how impactful it is on our health well-being, but also because in many regards, biology has some aspects of language, right? Both in terms of components and syntax and transcription. And it's evident that that is it's a puzzle or a challenge that human beings have taken quite some time and effort and haven't yet been able to solve. And with some AI, we believe that a lot of these deep questions we as a human race have finally the ability to tackle at scale. I think there's been, everybody's heard about, or most of listeners have heard of AlphaFold, where DeepMind was able to create a meaningful mapping between the sequence of amino acids and the 3D structure of proteins and the amazing consequences thereof. I think being able to leverage that into understanding how to use manipulate proteins and leverage them is going to be absolutely huge. Probably the biggest breakthrough over the last 20 years in biology, modulo maybe CRISPR.
It's interesting on AlphaFold though, I remember it didn't just beat it and they understood within, from my, I think it's AlphaFold 2, and understanding how proteins fold. But then they just mapped and said, by the way, here's the database of all known proteins ever. Yeah. My understanding on the timing, though, was this was done obviously before the ChatGPT moment. So, you know, help me as someone who doesn't have a PhD. It's not the same AI tech. It's not generative AI. It's not the same fundamental ways that they're doing large language models. Is that correct? And then what does that mean that LLMs and that type of tech and transformers have opened up?
Yeah, it's a good point. Yeah, so the algorithms are actually indeed somewhat different. You know, going back to ChatGPT, basically large language models are, you know, we call it generative AI, but it's really predicting what the next word is, right? That's really what it is. So it's looking at, and it's called a foundational model. It's, you know, looking at huge amounts of data and curating out of them, or creating out of them, learning out of them patterns that apply across a very wide range of tasks where you don't actually have to train on specific mappings. For AlphaFold, there were, I don't remember the exact number, but maybe 100,000, 150,000 mappings between sequences and structures that were fed into the model, and it was able to learn off of that. So yes, these are different algorithms. It was, you know, you're right that I think both AlphaFold and AlphaFold 2 came out before ChatGPT. I think at the same time, kind of there's a wide range of algorithms that were that came into vogue over the last, call it 5 to 10 years, given the huge jump and leap in compute. Right, neural networks have been around since probably the late 1960s, so quite some time, right? But they were brushed aside because they, you know, we didn't have computers strong enough to actually make any use of them. So in 2011, 2012, suddenly we had this compute and the results were phenomenal. I remember the first time I personally ran an automatic speech recognition engine that was using deep neural networks and not Gaussian models that were used before then, and saw like an increase of, you know, or decrease of 50% in error rate, and was like, this is science fiction. How is this even working, right? So you're right that these are different types of algorithms. There's kind of a third type of algorithm that is also made some news over the last 5 years, that all that kind of AlphaGo or AlphaChess, mm-hmm. AlphaZero of the world that use, you know, reinforcement learning, which are also different. So not large models, not large language models, and definitely not only mappings, right? So there's different families of algorithms that come to the fourth. I think the reason biology is really interesting is because it's a novel puzzle. A lot of these, the compute is now there. A lot of the data is there. And looking at this, most of this won't be large language models, right? Most of it will either be mappings like AlphaFold or, and I believe more so kind of these policy learnings like the AlphaGo, kind of, you know, what letting basically biology play a game with itself, the game of life, mm-hmm. and seeing what actually happens and what evolves. So, you know, we all start from one fertilized cell. What is the game that the cell plays with itself and its surroundings, the different signals that come in that let this one single cell develop into a perfectly tuned being or organism? And how does that work? And kind of letting the cells play the game. And we know to some degree what the end game should look like what a win looks like. A win is a perfectly shaped organism, right? And how do we do that?
So for the kind of that foundational level of biology models that we're starting to see happen, does the different, like the reinforcement learnings, the large language model equivalents, or the AlphaFold, the mapping, do they start stacking? Like, can you using all of them together to create? Does something, is it merely like, was it the compute power has exploded? Hence, we've all seen NVIDIA's revenue, and they're just like, you know, I laughed the other day when I heard about Stargate and OpenAI and Microsoft doing the $100 billion supercomputer that they're trying to put together. I was sitting at, you know, NVIDIA and AMD, I'd be like, I'm just going to start counting the money. Is it printing in? Yes, please do that. So is it that computer?
It's trying to raise $7 trillion, no, or something like that. I read somewhere.
Well, yeah, it was $7 trillion, and now it's $100 billion for the. So the $100 billion just pocket change for the what they're trying to do.
Exactly.
But so, I mean, is it just the compute, or is the fact that we're having all of these different? You said like neural networks have been since the '60s, and now that they're opening up, but do they start coming together? These technical breakthroughs and opening up what's possible.
Yeah. So first, to clarify, the concept of neural networks has indeed been around, I believe, since the 60s, maybe even the 50s. But they're, you know, very in very coarse terms, right? They were more of a mathematical abstraction or a mathematical model rather than something that could be put into use. And then I think in the 90s, there was more attempts to implement them, but just kind of the compute wasn't there. The fact that compute has grown so much has made this something real and allowed people to start playing around with so it's both the data and the compute. And then once a lot of academic attention is focused on it, algorithms become much, much, much stronger, right? So definitely the algorithms being used today did not exist 50 or 60 years ago, right? To be very, very clear. And a lot of these novel algorithms are it's not just a small step forward. They're real conceptual changes. Transformers were introduced. I forget what year. 16, 17. I don't remember. With attention is all you need. Like the breakthrough paper. I don't remember the exact year. So listeners,
2017 is what stuck in my head. So the fact that you said 60 makes it sound like that's about right that time.
These are real breakthroughs, algorithmically speaking. Do they stack together? I think for sure mappings policy learnings are for sure going to stack together 100%. For large language models, it's a bit different. I don't know. That's really something that is kind of, I don't want to say unique to language, but it's very much a matter of also having these incredible amounts of data and also specifically kind of being able to answer questions, right? So, you know, when you think of diffusion networks and generating graphics, is that Gen AI? And they're not using large language models, but they're using very different types of of algorithms, including generative adversarial networks, et cetera, et cetera. So I do think there will be synergy between these approaches. I know at my current company today, we definitely, when we think of our AI platform, we're definitely marrying different algorithms together from the two different families, for sure. And I think the kind of the AlphaFold approach is one that is more classical, right? It's just, quote unquote, it's just looking at a given a sequence, what the result is and learning from that, right? And how you learn has hugely evolved, but that's kind of more classical. And whereas the reinforcement learnings and learnings of strategies are more novel and more nascent. And we know less about them as well.
So I think it's a good moment to pivot is I want to talk a little bit about Somite and how we think about where these models fit in the stack of creating things for healthcare and the evolution from, I mean, obviously AlphaFold is the one, like I'm somewhat deep in this, but like that's the one everybody knows about, but it's starting to explode and go in this direction. So how do you think about what you're building at Somite in this kind of lineage?
Yeah, first about AlphaFold, I think it's literally one of the biggest breakthroughs of the century, and I wouldn't be surprised if DeepMind was the first entity to win a Nobel Prize in sciences. Like it's absolutely huge. the ramifications are still very early compared, like it's really solved a real huge problem in this space of biology, like previously completely a question that was unanswerable. And there are more similar and more complex questions out there, right? Mapping between structure and function is also something that is still very, very much unsolved. For us specifically,
I was going to say, to your point, the problem has been in biology is that every single time we make a major breakthrough, the Human Genome Project, it always ends up becoming, okay, but we got to learn just that one more thing and then we've got it.
Yeah.
It's a difficult science to be in.
Yes, for sure. But yes, and at the same time, there have been so many these breakthroughs have led to so many beautiful things. And I'm sure that
absolutely
AlphaFold in and of itself will help lead to discovery and quicker iterations on novel drugs and targets, etc. For SOMITE specifically, the way we're thinking of things is we're trying to learn the trajectories of cells from a pluripotent stem cell all the way to how it ends up becoming a mature cell. So trying to really map out the fates of cells and predict the states of cells from a very early stage, what's called a pluripotent stem cell. So we all start from a single fertilized cell, which is obviously a stem cell. It's what's called a totipotent stem cell. It can create any cell in the body, but more so also kind of the placenta and the umbilical cord, etc. So it's kind of this super, super stem cell. And as the cell splits and differentiates, it becomes a pluripotent stem cell, namely one that can create any cell in the body. And these cells mature along their trajectories and become more and more mature cells and lose their pluripotency. Some of them remain stem cells, but specifically designed stem cells, ones that it can create only a specific type of tissue. There's a deep question of what signals and what environments you have to give every cell. Kind of what the language of the cell is, if you will, that you need to, like, what signals does it need to get in order to mature into a specific cell, so a specific useful cell. So as an example, SOMITE is aiming to become kind of the OpenAI for stem cell biology, to say it at a very high level, where and use the platform that we're generating that we're developing to generate novel therapeutics, novel cures, using these stem cells. So to give you kind of a feel, one of the first diseases we're looking at as a proof of principle is a horrible, horrible disease called Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. And there've been many different approaches to that with gene therapy and other approaches. Our approach is using the cells themselves as a cure or as a treatment. And to do that, what we're doing is we're going to be grafting or injecting what are called satellite cells. Satellite cells are muscular stem cells. A stem cell is defined by the fact that it does two things. One is it generates more mature cells. And two, it regenerates itself, right? It replenishes itself. So it creates, it divides also into itself. We have some pretty amazing preclinical results on mice showing that you can literally grow a muscle, a completely atrophic muscle. You can regenerate it almost in entirety from injection of these satellite cells. Now, bringing back AI into the story, we're basing our work on an effort that has been conducted by one of the scientific co-founders. He's a professor out of Harvard Medical School and Mass General. He's also the president of the International Society for Developmental Biology. So one of the top people in the world in developmental biology, period. And he spent 12 years trying to coax cells to become these satellite cells. They were kind of, so I'll go a bit into background. In 2006, kind of given education on pluripotent stem cells. In 2006, this Japanese scientist called Yamanaka showed that if you take four factors, you could basically take any cell and turn the clock back and turn it into basically a pluripotent stem cell, which was great because suddenly you have this huge promise that you can create basically any type of cell in the body. And you can imagine like this huge warehouse, like an Amazon for cells that you can just use to fix problems in the body. Yeah, that's what it was, right? The hope was. As it turns out, it's much harder to tell a cell to go forward in time to the exact specific cell you want it to go than to reverse it in time. And it makes sense in a way, right? Reversing it is just saying, you know, exactly, basically taking any mature cell and just playing around with a few things, pressing the right buttons, and it goes back to an infancy, to pluripotency. Telling a cell how to go into a mature cell state or directing it to a specific fate is quite hard because it's not one stage. You have to coax it along the way. Every step that the cell develops, you need to give it another signal. So you're basically following the way a cell matures in the body, right? It has to go through, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 states, which are in themselves an abstraction, until they get to the fate or the state that you want them to be at. So in 2015, 2016, one of my scientific co-founders, Olivier, published two seminal papers showing how to produce for the first time satellite cells. And that was a huge breakthrough, right? Because suddenly idea of a warehouse for cells was more than an idea. You could actually create these cells. The problem was that the level of purity that he was able to create was quite low. It was less than 25%, which was posed huge problems if you wanted to actually use those cells. So only one out of the four cells that you started out with, or not that you said, that you ended up with was the right type of cell, and then how do you separate, et cetera, et cetera. And then what happened is he spent kind of a micro sabbatical with one of my other scientific co-founders, also out of Harvard Medical School. And together they looked at the data and they were like, oh, with some data science and some machine learning, we can actually improve purity substantially and make it something that is actually usable. And that was kind of the epiphany. And today the purity is much higher than 25%. It's closer to 75% using different hacks. And at a level that can be used. And suddenly you have this marriage of the deep understanding of biology, of human, like humans' understanding of biology, marrying it with data science, machine learning, and, you know, data science and machine learning. And suddenly you have this incredible asset that you can use to develop drugs. And the way we're thinking about it at SOMITE is to build this platform that would basically allow you to map from any cell state to any of its later cell states and just find the cues. And this is much more of a problem like AlphaGo rather than AlphaFold, because it's like a game, right? You need to give it different signals at different states in order to get to the end state. So that's kind of how we're thinking about it in my specific company. But so I think go ahead.
I'm gonna repeat and make sure I got it. So going backwards, the Yamanaka factors are basically stable. It's here's the four things you need to do, and here's how you get them backwards. Going forward, almost similar to your point with AlphaGo, it's this ridiculous tree of possible outcomes.
Exactly.
And so each tree requires a different process to do. So I want to get from here to that. The idea being that SOMITE's going to map the tree.
Exactly.
And the end result is great. We've mapped the tree. We've gone backwards. We got our stem cell. We've gone forward. We now have the satellite cell that we want, and there's our therapeutic.
Exactly. So you said it even nicer than I did. And the search space, as you can imagine, is absolutely huge because you have these bifurcations or these branches of the tree, and there's so many different options to check at each stage and what happens, and they're all natural or legitimate, right? You know, this is what happens, right? And the question is, what factors do you add at every, or what, you know, what biochemical signals do you add at every state in order to get from one stage to another? You know, Somite is one of many different companies looking at this. There are different approaches to this. There are kind of other companies like the BitBios of the world and GCTXs of the world that are also looking at similar things. They're taking a different approach, which is kind of, they're looking at just inducing a transcription factor. So looking outside of the natural or the natural trajectory of cells. What we are doing is we're limiting ourselves to the digital twin of the embryo. So part of what we're doing is actually putting together the ground truth of how things happen in the body. So we're not trying to do anything outside of nature, right? We're not trying to take one cell and move it to a completely different state of a cell in a trajectory that doesn't occur in the embryo. So we have this pre-bias of only following the natural trajectories. There are other companies that are basically saying, you know, let's brute force this. Let's use absolutely every signal possible and look at a much larger search space. And you know, it's a different kind of approach to the question, and both are legit. We'll see. I think their approach is a little more risky in the sense that today all of the clinical trials using cells are all follow a natural trajectory. So there haven't yet been any transcription factor, kind of direct programming of cells that have made it to clinical trials. Our approach is less risky in the sense that we're just doing what nature does. Really that's what we do, but outside of, you know, in vitro, basically.
Since the end result is cell therapies and the ones that we have are still notoriously hard to manufacture, like the actual distribution side, everything that kind of goes into what happens after we make the drug. So two questions there. One is, does this approach from the natural method, as you kind of put it, affect that at all? And then if yes or no, then the second part is, can we be thinking about that part of, okay, how we make the drugs, how we create the therapies, given just how difficult the manufacturing side is, can these type of approaches help to solve that as well? Or is it really just getting to the point of here's the right therapeutic?
No, it's a great question. In truth, there are three real challenges. So kind of the holy grail of cell therapy is to, you know, control generation of all cell types, right? That's the holy grail, right? There's three grand challenges in order to bring forth novel therapies. And there are three really grand challenges or sub-challenges to that. One is the first, which is accessing these very hard-to-access lineages. That's the first one, and we've talked a bit about that. So satellite cells are an example, but we tackle multiple different lineages. The name of my company is Somite. Somite is, you can think of it as a small factory exists at the very beginning or at the early stage of the development of the embryo. It's a part of the mesoderm germ layer, so the middle one. Scientists have known for quite some time to produce neurons, et cetera, which are part of the ectoderm, the external layer, et cetera. But within the somite, from cells that are derived from somites that the somite ends up producing, there's many other types of cell lineages other than satellite cells or other than muscle. There's bone, there's cartilage, there's ligaments, there's the dermis, the skin, et cetera, et cetera. And all of these pose, you know, each one of these lineages is a challenge in and of its own. But the first challenge to take back a bit is actually producing these hard-to-access lineages or cell fates. Then the second is actual production of the cells, right? So how to do this at a low cost, how to do this at scale with the right purity, et cetera, which is also something that we're tackling. And then the third one is a delivery, right? How do you actually deliver these cells in a way that is viable, right? So, for example, there are two therapeutic approaches. One is to go for autologous therapies, which basically mean you take a cell from a person and create what you need in vitro and then put it back into the same person so that there's no immune response. And the problem with that is that it is extremely costly because you literally need to create a cell line for each patient. You see that with like CAR T therapies. So again,
it's usually not right by the bedside.
Right. No, it's not at all.
You have to fly to their lab, do the things and come back.
And it takes time and it's hugely costly. And so you see that with CAR T therapies. To be very clear, CAR T is cell therapy, but it's not cell replacement therapy. Mm-hmm. So you're not using these kind of stem cells as a therapy, or you're basically engineering cells outside of the body. And so very much not what we do at Somite. And then there are allogeneic therapies, which are, you know, basically taking a stem cell, differentiating into the state you want and injecting it back into the body from a different person, right? And then kind of there are a few issues there. One is there will be an immune response unless it's an immunoprivileged organ. So like, for example, there's great advances in treatments with neurons because the brain is immunoprivileged. So there's a very little, if any, immune reaction there. So you can use neurons to, and there's some amazing results out of Blue Rock and out of Novo for Parkinson's treatment. And then as well for epileptic seizures as well. So pretty incredible results because the brain is immunoprivileged. So either you have that or you have diseases that are so terrible that people would be willing to be immunocompromised in order to get this treatment. So one example is Duchenne. And then there's the kind of the third approach, which is one that we will ultimately be taking at Somite, and I think, you know, is really the future of the field, is to look at cloaking. Is basically ensuring that the cell lineages that are used are kind of universal and don't basically stir up the immune system or don't activate the immune system. And I think that's kind of the third grand challenge of how to deal with immunoreactions and how do you use cells to cure without creating this immune system reaction.
But once you solve all that, we're good, right?
Yeah, it's very small. So I think specifically, if we look at the lay of the land, there's some incredible results for cell replacement therapy. And remember, we call it cell replacement therapy is not CAR T and it's not blood transfusions, et cetera. It's not CAR Ts. And there's some really amazing, incredible initial results. So both for beta cells, which are the insulin producing cells. So there are a bunch of companies out there that are showing pretty amazing results. I think Vertex has now 5 or 6 patients that are completely insulin free. They are able, you know, type 1 diabetes people that just didn't have beta cells, and they are now, after grafting, they are insulin-free. They can live their lives without injecting insulin, which is pretty amazing. And likewise, some amazing results for Parkinson's with neurons.
The word cure is actually on the table.
It is, but very carefully. I was just off a call with a great scientist who said, "Do not use the C word." And he said, "And I don't mean and I don't mean what you're thinking about, right?" So, you talk about treatments, not cures.
I understand the hesitancy. I understand the things that in the past, but when we are solving, when the treatments are solving things at the fundamental level, it's not merely, "Hey, you don't have enough insulin, so I'm going to give you insulin. I'm going to instead get you back to producing insulin,"
exactly.
Or what we've seen with, the sickle cell drugs from Vertex, right? And those are CRISPR-based. Like, we're actually getting at the fundamental layer of what's wrong
100%.
And trying to solve that. And solving that, solving the fundamental problem of the disease is the definition of a cure.
Yes, 100%. I think the reservation from cure is because it still hasn't yet been proven, and
sure,
the promise for some of these diseases is so huge, and And you know, I've had the honor of meeting several young men with Duchenne's, and seeing what they you know have to live with is and their courage. So we don't want to taunt the word cure yet, but definitely you know, alleviation and treatment 100%. And I think that, you know, I don't have a crystal ball, but I would be extremely surprised if in the next 20 years we don't have actual real solutions for a variety of these diseases. And I think AI is going to play an absolute key role on all three challenges, right? A, accessing these hard to access cell lineages, number one. Number two, production. And number three, delivery. So all three of these will be tackled by AI in different ways. But I think putting together these truly foundation models of how cells interact with each other, kind of putting together the, rather than large language models, cell language models, right? And learning the game of life, really the game of life. You called it beautifully the tree, which is you know, when I, that one of the, like the third or fourth, slide in my pitch deck is showing these this tree of all the cells and how they grow out, and showing here we know how to do, here we don't know how to do. So looking at those, I think is something that will be solved for exhaustively over the next 10 to 20 years. Production, I also believe, will be solved, and delivery is, we're already seeing some really nice solutions coming out. So I don't think this is something that happens in the next 2 years or 5 years, but I think 20 years from now, medicine will be in a completely different place.
I think that's a wonderful way to then think about how the shifting possibilities of medicine, and then how does the business model of these types of companies start to shift? And I know, you know, for the audience, you and I have debated this, you know, not on the air. So it'd be fun to have this discussion here, but it's interesting, right? Because as far as I know, I mean, AlphaFold, it was a research project to solve protein folding. And then the database that they created of all the known structures was, again, they just gave out for free. There was no licensing. There was no this. So on one hand, there's amazing research that's going on. I don't know if DeepMind is getting any sort of revenue from this perspective. We talk about the, you know,
if it's okay if I pause you for a second or interject for a second. So two things. One, they didn't just give out, right? I think I recently read an interview with them as they consulted, I think, like 20 or 30 bioethicists, and like it was a real question, like, are you giving people a map into kind of creating proteins that could harm humanity terribly, et cetera. So they looked at it very, very deeply, and at the end of the day, they decided that kind of open sourcing it would be much more advantageous than not. And the second component is, you're right that they gave away they gave away the model, but things that they, you know, they still obviously keep some things that are, you know, to themselves. And
sure.
And then they found it out of, so there's Isomorphic Labs that is basically based on this to some degree. And you know, I think Demis is CEO, but I'm not sure, I can quickly check. And that is a for-profit company, and it's, I don't know if it's part of Verily or whatever, but definitely for profit.
So, but is the, and I'm not like, my question then is the business model for Isomorphic Labs assets? Is it clinical assets? Is that the?
Yeah, the truth is I don't know, but I checked. He is the CEO of Isomorphic Labs. It's a subsidiary of Alphabet, so I don't know if Verily or not. And I don't know what the I don't know what their business model is, but my guesses would be to develop and partner with assets. So I don't know how early, like, look, taking an asset to market is extremely difficult, right? Very few companies are successful in doing that. You usually, you know, you need huge machineries, everything from marketing to regulatory and distribution, et cetera, et cetera, policy. So usually what companies, biotechs, end up doing is they sell relatively early, right? Or partner relatively early. But that doesn't mean that their business model isn't asset related or asset. I don't know Isomorphic well enough to tell you if they're selling data or algorithms or access or assets. My guess would be assets, but I don't know. Look, it's a great question whether or not this will be a business in which you're selling the platform or the assets from the platform. There's a kind of, I think I must have told you this when we spoke earlier, that the aphorism in the field is if you're a successful platform company, you'll survive long enough to have an asset. I'll also share another anecdote. Recently, kind of when we were thinking through our business model, I spoke with two great CEOs whom I'll obfuscate their names and companies, but both have been founders of companies well over billions of dollars, and one has moved on to another company, and one is still with his initial company. And I asked them kind of, so should this be should we be selling the AI as a service or as a kind of, or should we be developing our assets? And interestingly enough, the person that was building a platform said, there's no money in the platform, go after the asset. And the person that did the asset said, there's no way you're going to be able to raise money for the asset, go after the platform.
There's no right answer.
Right. No, or the grass is greener on the other side.
Think,
you know, with the hype on the AI side, it's much easier to raise on a platform or a tech bio play. I think the actual money is in the biotech play at the end of the day. Like, you're selling the real value is in the asset. Now, do you need to take the asset all the way? Absolutely not. When we're thinking about our assets at within Somite, we're thinking of different indications in different ways. So small indications like Duchenne is relatively easy to advance quite forward. So, you know, taking something to phase 1-2 is $12-15 million, and then only like $5 million to actually run the first trials, and you have actual results, and suddenly the company could be worth hundreds and hundreds of millions based on results, and that could be done relatively quickly. On the one hand, on the other hand, you know, there is this huge promise of putting together this all powerful AI platform, and you wanna show it off. The question is, who do you sell it to? The real issue is, if you speak with pharma companies, you'll run into what's called the NIH, the not invented here syndrome. There's a lot of buzz around AI also in pharma companies. Very few, it's a very different DNA, pun not intended. AI, machine learning, moves at the pace of electrons, and assets move at the pace of proteins. A very, very different pace.
It's this amazing tension that we see where things are going.
Yeah.
And at some point, there's either going to be a flip or a break. Because if we get to the point of the N equals one drug, and I can see in the situation of the mapping of that tree of every cell layered on with the individual's genetic, like, this is the path to it. And
yeah.
And then also, like, rare diseases, like ultra rare diseases, like, and 10 people, 20 people, whatever the number, we're just financially, it, no matter what, the numbers don't work out.
Yeah.
But you can do this. That becomes on the table. And then, as you put it, like, if I've got an N of one drug, there's no way to monetize that individual drug. It's, you monetize the platform in the box. And it's, but you're right. Then when we think about the structure of clinical trials, we think about the structure of the regulatory path, which is, here's your thing. You've given me all the data. I'm going to approve the one drug. Those things have to evolve and shift for us in any way to have that that business model shift. But then I can see it, like, okay, great. Like, you format yourself as like the OpenAI, you know, for cell therapy. And we think about that they're selling the service, right? They're selling, I mean, ChatGPT happens to be the, you know, for a lot of people that, and how I pay is that one final layer on top.
Yeah.
But you can clearly see that the platform is the way that we're eventually going to go.
Yes.
And it's going to be one of those things, like it happens slowly and then it happens quickly.
Yes, 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 100%. So I fully agree. I think just in order to de-risk our own company, we're going to definitely do both. And that kind of creates a schizophrenic effect because like half of our people are biotech people and they're, you know, everything needs to be very slow and very careful and rightfully so. Regulated and half of the people are kind of let's ship code, right? Which happens much, much quicker. So there is this even internal tension. And I think the way we're looking at it, first of all, we don't have the answers. It really feels sometimes that we have like these two internal powers or entities within. We're definitely going to be building a platform approach, and we're also definitely going to be developing our own asset. Otherwise, I think we haven't done anything but created risk for the company. So 100% going to develop our first asset and hopefully take it all the way to phase 1-2 and maybe even beyond. Once you get there, kind of partnerships become much, much easier, obviously, right? And you've also proven out the platform. And then once you've used that asset to de-risk the platform, I think it becomes quite evident with the value of the platform. And you can go on and have conversations with pharma companies, basically asking them, okay, so what indications do you care about? What cell lines are you targeting? And kind of working with them in order to develop these specific cells that they are interested in.
So how do you think, you mentioned a bunch of competitive approaches to this and the way that they're thinking about the models and they're building it out. But one of the things that I've noticed is that the companies farther down in the tech stack are slowly creeping up. I mean, even the time that you and I were talking about coming together for this, NVIDIA launched their own new bio foundational models and toolkits. And how do you think about, because we're still in that early stage, we don't know where the line is. I mean, the ChatGPT developer day killed 1,000 startups. And they said, look what we're doing now, right? The wrapper company's gone.
Yeah, the wrapper, yes, 100%. So I think it's different in the sense, I think if I'm not mistaken, NVIDIA invested like $50 million in
Recursion,
in
I think.
Recursion.
Yeah.
I don't think at the chip level there's going to be, you know, chip levels are enablers. They're really the shovels and the picks and shovels. I don't think they'll be able to replace the layer above at all. It's in that sense, we're not just a wrapper or anywhere near that, right? It's a real expertise and real. We're very, very, very far from that, actually. I think what we'll end up seeing is, and also like kind of not to toot our own horn too much, but kind of if you look at the DNA of our founders, you know, we have the chair of the genetics department at Harvard. We have the president of the International Society for Developmental Biology. We have another professor who won the inaugural James Award for the National Academy of Sciences and the head of the fundamental AI group out of MIT, all are my co-founders at the company. These are not, I mean, you can find these level of people maybe at DeepMind and that's it really. These are really like the top scientists in the world working on the problem. So I think that there's no risk for SOMITE specifically or for similar companies to be disrupted by the lower level. I do think there are collaborations. I think, you know, NVIDIA, AMD, and the rest are going to try to create these ecosystems that are very much attuned to the layer above, much like kind of AWS did in a very, very mm-hmm. smart way, right? Creating these suites of tools for developers to work with and kind of the major advantage that AWS has over GCP and Azure, et cetera, are the kind of the toolkits that they've built over and the ecosystem. So I think you're definitely going to see that. But I think the applications are so diverse and unique and need deep sophistication understanding that it's not going to be something that crawls up from, I mean, there's no way that a, sorry, I don't want to say no way, but I don't believe that a hardware company will develop the scientific expertise needed in order to actually deploy applications. So I think very far from that. The question I think to ask is, will there be a mid-level of companies that are just platformatic? And, you know, for example, exactly like what happened with AlphaFold, right? If anybody was working, if there were a company working on targeting specific types of proteins or discerning the function from structure, and then AlphaFold were released, that would be kind of painful for that company, right? So, you know, if your company comes along and does develop these, you know, what we're calling for now AlphaSTEM, these foundational models, I think it will be hugely valuable and disrupt a lot. I still think there's a real case in point to have companies that develop assets that are very specific with the exact know-how about it. You know, biology is a very, very messy science. It's not as you know, straightforward as AI is.
We're learning. It's funny that you say AI straightforward, but versus biology, it is. One of the things I wanted to kind of do in our last little bit here is the, you know, the lineage and pedigree of your co-founders is amazing. And they're all coming out of, you know, Boston, which is kind of like the longtime heavyweight in bio. You're in Austin. One, how are we seeing this bridge being able to be done? And two, what are you seeing as the difference in the kind of the first principles between like the Boston and now kind of growing Austin biotech and health ecosystem?
Yeah, so you're right. Boston is you know, a heavyweight. It's also very conservative. So there are playbooks of how to raise money in Boston that are very kind of farmer oriented. Very, you know, they take into account a lot of risk. So they're much, you know, when I started working on SOMITE and I started interacting with the various different venture firms, I was kind of flabbergasted to learn like that a lot of these firms wanted to invest, but wanted to take 50, 60, 70% of the company. And I was like, wait, what?
Oh my God.
And I was like, that's not the world I come from. Can you explain? And you know, they didn't really explain, but I learned that really what happens is at the end of the day, these are firms and ecosystems that learn how to invest in an asset, in a molecule, in a cell, in a therapeutic. They're not investing in the team and in the ability to disrupt, which is kind of really antithetical to Silicon Valley, call it, right? Or Silicon Hills in Austin. So Austin is much more similar in its approach to kind of Silicon Valley and standard kind of startup world. Boston is leans much heavier towards pharma and more risk heavy approaches. And the idea there is kind of the founders are really often not exactly founders, but they're like employees with a nice amount of equity. It's true. And there are many VCs that are foundries that literally they spin out or spawn these companies based on, you know, they identify one or two or three amazing scientists with a good idea, and then they build a company around that, right? And then the scientists end up having, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5% of the company and not more because of the risk assigned to it and et cetera, et cetera. So that's kind of not how we're approaching things at all. We've raised a really nice seed round, and we've done it on our terms. I, you know, first of all, it helped that I put in the first amount of money to kind of set the tone. But and second of all, kind of we're de-risking things both by the platform, the AI, and having an initial asset. So I think Boston is, to sum things up, Boston is a different model than what you and I know as startups. I think kind of bringing this Austin mindset has been very helpful to me personally. Basically, we still control the company and very, you know, entirely. Hopefully we'll continue to do so for many more years. On the other hand, there's a huge amount to learn from Boston. And you asked about the bridge. In all truth, I don't know about the bridge. The bridge is me. I fly out every week. So the bridge is exhausting. I don't know. I'm very excited about the prospect of Boston going deeper into health. I think University of UT is incredible and has the top professors, and it would be amazing. There were this amazing summit by Briar Capital a few weeks ago, and some great speakers there talking about the future of Austin. So very much for it. I think it's about bringing in not only the founders but also the investors that to learn how to deal with these types of deals here in Austin.
So I think that's the perfect place to end where I always end. Micha, what's next Austin?
What's next in Austin? Wow, I don't know. I've only been here 2.5 years, so I live in the present in Austin. I think Austin's biggest asset is its people. People here are kind, they're open, they're not closed, they are wonderful in embracing other people and innovation. I would absolutely love to see Austin become a force of nature in moving innovation forward. We need a better airport, that I can tell you. And I think we need to build out, and I know you're already, I've been to several meetups that you've organized that were absolutely fantastic, create this ecosystem, this community of entrepreneurs, so that when people decide they're going to build a biotech company, Austin is on the map. So I really believe and hope that Austin is going great places. Communities are key, right? There's a reason that Silicon Valley looks the way it does, for good and for worse, and the reason that Boston does as well. And I think Austin does need an infusion of both capital and firms. And I think many great things can come out of here.
I know it's been, and always want to make sure that we think that the past of Austin, it's been a 30-year journey of overnight success, but at the same time, it still very much feels like being on the ground floor.
Yeah. So even in the time I've been here, I've seen a lot of amazing developments. I know a few VCs that are building themselves out here now in Austin have had the pleasure to interact and raise funds from some incredible funds that are based out here in Austin. I think what Austin, a lot of free thinkers, a lot of people that, it's still early days. So people can think outside of the box. And I think with the natural kindness that Austinites have and thoughtfulness and kind of this pioneering approach, I think a lot of amazing things will happen. I think Austin, hopefully, is just at the very, very beginning of disrupting tech.
I love it. Micha, thanks for coming back on the podcast.
Of course. It's always, always a pleasure.
So what's next, Austin? We're glad you've joined us on this journey. Please subscribe at your favorite podcast catcher, leave us a review, and let your colleagues know about us. This will help us grow the podcast and continue bringing you unique interviews and insights. Thanks again for listening, and see you soon.